Johnny Burgess called me from up in the county, and she said, Patty, she said, this is not a recycling plant. It's going to be a hazardous waste incinerator. Not one, but five.
Most of this country's hazardous waste is burned or buried in poor or rural communities. In the next edition of Earth on the Air, Disposable Home Place, a look at people who are standing up to the waste industry.
From Seattle, the Earth on the Air Radio Works presents Earth on the Air.
Where would you put something nobody wants to live next to? Every year, our country generates over 20 billion tons of toxic waste and disposes of hundreds of millions of tons of garbage. In the next half hour, an Earth on the Air special presentation, Disposable Home Place. Producer Dan Jaffe travels to four rural communities that were selected as sites for toxic waste incinerators or landfills. Local residents talk about how they fought back and how they began to come to grips with their own role as producers of waste. First, Kettleman City, California, on the western edge of the San Joaquin Valley, home to about 1,500 people. The California Aqueduct passes through town, carrying drinking water to Los Angeles. But Interstate 5 brings in a different kind of flow, tanker trucks loaded with hazardous waste. A group of Kettleman residents organized to protect the health of their families and hold the line on toxic waste.
Bueno, mi nombre es Ramón Mares.
He says his name is Ramón Mares.
Tenemos el problema.
We have the problem of
de unas enfermedades que nos ha pegado aquí a la comunidad.
Of some illnesses that have plagued our town.
Y otras enfermedades como rasquera.
And other illnesses like rashes, itchiness.
Y problemas respiratorios.
And problems of the respiratory tract.
Y creo que todo se lo debemos a Ken Waste.
And I think we all owe it to Ken Waste. My name is Merlu Mares, and I'm with People for Clean Air and Water. We've been fighting a proposed toxic waste incinerator for 5 years now. And so far we've had great victories, but it's not over. We're still fighting it. Well, for me, I was living in ignorant bliss, you know. I was just a housewife, just tending to my house and minding my own business, which I thought I had, you know, found the perfect little town to raise my child in and to live happily ever after. And we discovered that, you know, this little town has turned into a nightmare, you know. Now we're thinking of maybe moving, you know, out of our dream house. The way I found out, I found a flyer on my door. It was a big skull, and it said, incinerator and come to this meeting, you know, and everybody was feeling something wrong with their health, and they decided to go and see what was going on.
My name is Luke Cole, and I'm an environmental poverty lawyer with California Rural Legal Assistance Foundation in San Francisco. One of the biggest cases that we've done so far is representing residents of Kettleman City in their fight against the siting of a toxic waste incinerator by Chemical Waste Management. And Kettleman City is a community that's about 95% Latino. 70% of the people speak Spanish in their homes. And it's currently the site of the largest toxic waste site west of the Mississippi. Chem Waste came into that community in the late 70s and opened up shop without the community's knowledge or consent, and has since developed that toxic waste dump into this massive, massive landfill. And in 1988, Chem Waste decided to expand that facility by building a toxic waste incinerator. And the people of Kettleman City basically said, we've had enough. In Chem Waste's case, for example, every single one of their toxic waste incinerators is located in a community that is 80% or more people of color. You talk about the south side of Chicago, you talk about Sauget, Illinois, you talk about Port Arthur, Texas, and now Kettleman City, California. All of those are communities that are overwhelmingly people of color.
Well, this area is mostly agricultural area. We're poor. We have no health insurance, and we cannot afford to have a dirty environment where we're always going to be sick and not be able to work.
Chemical Waste Management and the local county, Kings County, basically excluded people who spoke Spanish from the permitting process.
Good morning. My name is Mark Langowski. I work with Chemical Waste Management. When I was at the Kettleman Hills facility, I was the general manager of that facility for about 4 years. To paint a picture that there was a language barrier and a total disregard, I think would be painting the wrong picture. We would provide information that was translated into Spanish to provide input.
When the environmental impact report was issued, for example, it was a 1,000-page document, very dense and technical, no Spanish translation. When the residents of Kettleman City protested that, Chemical Waste Management translated an 8-page executive summary.
Well, you have to remember that this community is field workers. You know, it's hard to get a person that just came in from the field at 6 o'clock to go to a meeting at 7, you know, when they're so, you know, dog tired that they don't want to go to these meetings. And it's hard getting the people together. But this is what the company is counting on, that we have a bunch of tired people, not just physically, mentally, you know, trying to make it in this economy that we have now.
Unfortunately, the waste management industry is a target. We have no relationship, although some may challenge that, as to why waste is being generated. We do not generate it. We are here to ensure that it doesn't cause any harm. Pollution doesn't discriminate. It doesn't matter whether you're Hispanic, African American, etc. And it crosses all boundary lines.
When the Ku Klux Klan went out riding and looking for targets, they knew where to find their targets because they were residentially segregated into certain neighborhoods. Today, when Chemical Waste Management goes out and looks for its targets, poor people and people of color are still segregated into certain neighborhoods. I think that waste companies follow the path of least resistance. And for many reasons, low-income communities and communities of people of color have been perceived as the path of least resistance. What's happening around the country is that these communities are fighting back. They're speaking for themselves, they're taking on these companies, and they're winning.
Like I tell everybody, that if for some reason we do not win this incinerator fight, you know, it has not been a lost cause. I've learned a lot in these past 5 years that we've been fighting the incinerator, have gained a lot of confidence in myself, and as a consequence of that, I've taken myself out of the field, and I started taking classes at the junior college here, and I was brought up to always keep quiet, you know, don't make any waves, don't interfere, don't interrupt, don't be disrespectful. But I think this is part of our bringing up in the Hispanic community, that we are so quiet, you know, and we do not speak up for our rights or for anything, and we just let things happen to us. And I think that this is not right.
The Sorrell Report was a document that was brown bagged to me from a bureaucrat in another county who was what you might call a whistleblower.
Mary Burns is a community activist who works on waste issues in Mariloma, California. In 1986, a local official secretly passed Burns a copy of a state report that seemed to confirm suspicions long held by grassroots environmental groups.
The document identified communities that were the least able to resist large corporations' ability to cite hazards. So what the Sorrell report did was like the Rosetta Stone. It was the document that identified this is not an accident. All major hazards, be it siting a hazardous waste facility, a liquids, a landfill siting, all of these kinds of siting criteria are visible in the Sorrell report. It really is a shocking thing to realize that the people that you elect into office would pay to have a document printed to how to politically put something dangerous in the poorest neighborhoods. It's a shocking thing to realize that this is real. It's not a joke.
I think that the way siting is always done is that the dominant choice is economic, but that when the economic conditions are approximately the same, there will always be a racist bias built into the siting decision.
Will Collette is the former national director of the Citizens Clearinghouse for Hazardous Waste.
I think that the main motivation for solution in this country has been an organized people saying no. Waste reduction of toxics was considered to be some wild, crazy, stupid pipe dream 10 years ago. We made it become an economic and political necessity as a consequence of massive resistance that stopped up the toilet. I mean, the interesting thing over the past 12 years is that the grassroots movement has basically developed an unbeatable formula. Folks that follow the basic formula for absolute, total, and complete flat-out resistance, they don't lose.
Cold Kentucky morning, lazy piece of time, settles my mind, good as honeysuckle wine, got me feeling oh so fine.
Patty Wallace and Ruth Colvin used unorthodox tactics to defeat a hazardous waste incinerator proposed for their hometown in Appalachian, eastern Kentucky. The fight was just the beginning of their activism.
This is the landfill, the gates of the landfill that we managed to get closed.
And Wallace and Colvin became citizen monitors of all their county's waste activities, researching, testifying at meetings, even keeping an eye on illegally operated landfills.
Over on that side road is a clump of bushes and trees, so we could pull our car up behind there and yet see with our binoculars the numbers on the trucks.
Yeah, I am called a housewife from hell. Been called a lot worse, too. My name is Ruth Colvin, and I'm from Louisa, Kentucky. Born here, raised here. Came back home and got involved in the big incinerator goings on here in Lawrence County. I couldn't wait for it to be over, and then we got into a landfill, and I don't reckon we'll ever quit.
Okay, I'm Patty Wallace, and I'm from Louisa, Kentucky, and I'm also member of the Lawrence County Concerned Citizens and former chairperson of Kentuckians for the Commonwealth. I'm 62 years old and I'm a grandmother. Well, the first thing I saw was in the Big Sandy News, the local newspaper, had an article about a recycling plant coming in. Well, I'd been involved in a recycling group. We started about 1978. So I thought, great, this sounds really good. So finally there was going to be a public meeting at the courthouse, so I thought, well, I'll go. Well, a few days later, this lady called me, Johnny Burgess called me from up in the county, and she said, Patty, she said, this is not a recycling plant. It's going to be a hazardous waste incinerator. Not one, but five.
Well, I was living in Pike County when it first began. I know my mother had told me, oh, we're getting a fingernail polish plant down here. They're going to make fingernail polish removal. And I thought, well, isn't that great? Louisa's just a little town that's dying, being bypassed, and you know what? That'll be wonderful. And then the next time I talked to her, she said, why, honey, we found out it's a hazardous waste incinerator. And I said, well, I hope there's somebody to fight that.
So I went to the meeting, and the president of the company was there, and the vice president, and the fella got up, Jim Neal, and he told us what a wonderful place this would be. It was going to employ so many, like over 100 people. And he said, you know, I'm just a good old country boy. And he said, and my vice president, oh, he's just a good old country boy. And my secretary, she's just a good old country girl. And I thought, you creep. You know, trying to identify with us. I mean, that was just insulting. And later I told some fella, and he said, well, I always heard when they start that, you better keep your hand on your billfold.
And everyone accepted him for a while till they found out what it was. And as soon as they found out what it was, they felt like they'd been duped, and you just don't dupe Eastern Kentuckians and walk away. They got revenge in their heart.
We don't like for anybody to try to make a fool of us. Well, the thing we brought out is so close to where the schools were. It was close to a nursing home. It was close to the hospital. And where they have air inversions here all the time, like you mentioned, we're down in this valley, and sometimes it just hangs. That was the time when we knew that we had to get help, and about that time we got in touch with Kentuckians for the Commonwealth, and under their leadership and guidance, we started to educate ourselves, and we started studying about these places, going to workshops, doing background checks on all the owners and operators of the company. We learned our legislators. We made our trips to Frankfurt. We lobbied.
We were real intimidated at first when we went down there.
One of the best lobbyists down there, a woman, high paid, made the comment that we just didn't have any business down there. So in the beginning, we had a hard time getting to talk to anyone. Now, it's no problem. Of course, we did put wanted posters out for the Secretary of Natural Resources once and a few other little things.
But my children saw me on TV marching around the rotunda with a sign, and then later they saw me in the moon suit. They saw me in a moon suit, and they were really shocked. You know, we buried the state of Kentucky. We not only had the funeral flags, we had a hearse. We had a police escort through Frankfurt. We were all dressed in black. We had flowers. One of our members sang hymns. We had it all. It was the best thing we've ever done.
We got a bill passed. We lobbied. It took us two sessions, but we finally got Senate Bill 169, and that gives the county the right to say yes or no to the location of a hazardous waste incinerator in their county. And at the time PowerChem came, if the state said it can locate there, that's the way it was. You couldn't stop it. But we changed that.
You know, I hate to be called a NIMBY, but I guess I am a NIMBY. I don't want it in my backyard. I don't want my neighbor's backyard. I think companies are going to be forced to find ways to reduce and reuse their waste and not dump it on other people. If you make it, take care of it. When we started with PowerChem, I'm sure most of us thought, boy, I can't wait till we get rid of this thing so I can go back and live a normal life. Well, we've never been able to do it yet. So from now on, we will have to stay active in our politics of our county, and we attend all the zoning meetings, all fiscal court that we can, the community meetings, to try to stay on top of this.
Probably knowing more about what's going on than I do.
Well, could be.
I never expected to spend this later years of my life out chasing trucks and sleuthing and being Sam Spade. I always thought that the government took care of you.
Put a lot of people out of work, Patty.
Oh, that's terrible. I'm sure I did. That's better than killing them.
Watini se stihoa eladiga isoni.
Many Native American reservations around the country have been approached by the waste industry as possible sites for incinerators and garbage landfills. As tribes consider accepting waste from off-reservation, community groups are finding themselves at odds with their tribal leaders.
Hi, my name is Pam Kingfisher. I'm president of the Board of Directors of Native Americans for a Clean Environment out of Tahlequah, Oklahoma. We started getting a lot of phone calls from around the country about hazardous waste sites and landfills coming on to different reservations. And now I hear that in Cherokee, North Carolina, the same thing is happening there, where a waste company has come in, offered the chief a lot of money. He's signed deals quietly under the table, never told the tribe about it.
I'm Frank Bradley. I'm one half Cherokee, an enrolled member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Unions. We are aware that that the reservations have been targeted, and low-income people and sparsely populated areas. If you don't put up a resistance, they're going to put a landfill there.
Because of the sovereignty issue that the United States must treat each tribe as a sovereign nation, that means within the state has no regulatory authority over what the tribe does on their reservation land. And the EPA of that state does not have a right to come in and regulate things. It gives the companies a free rein and where they're not being watched, and they think they will be able to get away with a lot more and not be watched.
This landfill problem, you know, they didn't think there was going to be any problems with it, so they were just going to push it right on through. Didn't ask anybody, didn't talk to anybody. In fact, they tried to keep it quiet. Says, if we let everybody know, we're going to have all these activists out here giving us problems. That's like a quotation from one of their meetings.
Reservations and tribal governments are like a microcosm of this nation and the government, and so it's just brought down to a smaller scale. And most of the people in power on the reservations today are from that age group that went through the BIA boarding schools and lost their culture, and they're willing to sell the land. They're willing to sell their people out for a bundle of money. Very few of the tribes still have the traditional structures in place.
It appears that they have decided not to do a landfill at this time. They say that they're not going to put one in, but it could change within one council meeting. I think that we probably still have to watch very closely to make sure that they do what they say they're going to do.
Cynthia Smith, I'm from Hancock County, Georgia, Sparta. It's an 80% African American community in Southeast Georgia. In 1987, myself, Cynthia, and Bubba, we were thrift store owners in Sparta. We were in the business of recycling furniture and clothes, and Bubba was reading an article in the newspaper, Hancock County Commissioner's Mull over Hazardous Waste Incinerator. And in that article, it stated there would be 300 jobs. So my concern was, well, what's the big deal, you know? That's 300 jobs, and we could use some more employment in the community. Because back then, in 87, I didn't even know what hazardous waste was.
My name is John Michael McCown. Sparta, Georgia has the largest African-American population in the state of Georgia. Hancock County was the first county in the United States to be run by African-Americans since Reconstruction. The average person in Hancock County has a ninth grade education. In 1987, I was just being discharged from the United States Army, where I had served as a hazardous waste management officer. I was responsible of combining all of my battalion's waste by nature of compatibility and putting it on a plane or train or whatever and shipping it somewhere. It never dawned on me how this stuff that I was shipping out was impacting others. I never thought about where it was going. Well, upon leaving the military, I returned home to Sparta, Georgia. Bubba here stopped me and says, hey, did you hear about this incinerator that's coming into town? Well, I didn't act immediately, but it took me about 2 weeks to actually get in the groove, and we finally got organized, and the rest is history. There is no incinerator in Hancock County or the state of Georgia.
What the state was proposing was a hazardous waste incinerator. It was then Governor Joe Frank Harris, that was his pet project, and he was trying to get it online before 1990. So, but he made the wrong choice that time. He picked Hancock County. The state was trying to sell it as being safer than peanut butter. The state actually came to our community, and the people didn't go for it. They came in and said it was a public hearing. It would last all night, but the people were so angry, you know, after listening to what the state said, the people got so angry and started asking such hard questions that they closed that meeting down in 45 minutes and got out of Hancock County.
Hancock County is a very religious county, and so one of the major strategies I adopted was to go to the elected officials' churches and to stand up and make comments saying that basically they had sold the community out and that was ungodlike, and that they had the good shepherd had turned his back on the sheep and allowed the wolves to devour them and things like that. And it really hit a sore spot on them, and it would prove to be very effective.
Right around the same time that they had that meeting, this brother that was in a struggle with us had written a letter telling Joe Frank Harris to build the incinerator in his own backyard and to test it. And if it was successful, then we would take two of them in Hancock. So we were at the meeting that day, and Mark got in line and shook the governor's hand. So everybody introduced themselves. But when he got to me, I let him know that we were the opposition from Hancock County, that we didn't want the incinerator, to build it in his own backyard. While I was shaking his hand, I said all this to him, and he almost passed out. He turned red, and he said, "Oh, well, it's safe. You can, I don't understand you people, why you're so afraid, you know." And he let go of my hand, and by that time, I was getting ready to say something else. His bodyguards looked like they were going to attack me, so I just told him to build it in your own backyard. We don't want it. We don't need it, you know, so.
My father was a civil rights leader. But as a child watching my father, I didn't really understand the scope of what he was all about. But it wasn't until I became actively involved in this movement in 1987 that I realized that this is, in fact, a spiritual movement. It's actually about becoming in harmony with God's divine plan for his people and his earth.
It creates new leaders. A lot of the leaders, the good leaders in the fights, usually end up running for office and taking over the government, you know, and turning the government back over to the people. And every time I go to a community and they say they don't want the landfill, I say, well, what do you want? Do you recycle? You know, you got to start somewhere. So if you're saying you don't want all the trash from up north to come into your backyard, then everybody has to start recycling in their own home. We have a network, and we hook people up all across the nation that have fought the same foes, you know, the same enemies. And what I would like to see happen is the people of color movement come together with the grassroots environmental justice movement that is growing, because I think it's going to take us all, black and whites, working together.
For more information about this program, you can contact the Disposable Home Place Radio Project at area code 606-269-7719. Disposable Home Place was produced by Dan Jaffe for the Earth on the Air Radio Works. To find out about contributing your tape and ideas, write Earth on the Air at P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington 98145. This program was made possible by a grant from the Paul Robeson Fund for Independent Media and by the Mary Reynolds Babcock Foundation, the Town Creek Foundation, and listener members like you. Earth on the Air is mixed at Jack Straw Productions in Seattle. Our executive producer is Peter Mulliff, and special thanks to Vanessa May, Elena Rodrigo, and all the Earth on the Air volunteers and staff. Appalachian music was provided by the Real World String Band. If you'd like a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-800-3145. Mention that you're interested in show number 34. For the Earth on the Air Radio Works, I'm Janice Kane.